Welcome back to How to Unfuck Your Future. Yesterday, we went into the mind with Denise Shawl, Gio Valiente, and Stephen Goldstein about how we can all build psychological resiliency in these troubling times. Today, we're going from the mind to the blockchain as Rao welcomes back Yatsu, co-founder of Animoca Brands. I know I'm excited to hear about how blockchain and crypto might just help us all unfuck our futures. So over to you, Rao.
I can see Yat laughing in the side. Hey, Yat, how are you, my friend?
Very good. It's always a pleasure to be back on the show. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, not at all. Great to see you. So I want to catch up with you because you've always got lots of interesting thoughts about lots of things. So the way I like to make it easy to wrestle it somewhere is let's get your big picture mental model of where blockchain space, Web3, however you're thinking of it now is, and then we can go down to some component parts and areas of interest. Because you've always got an amazing mental model of this. So maybe
the best way that I mentioned this to you, I think in our first show, talk about sort of the importance of culture, right? And why we're so big into NFTs.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I would say, and one of the things I often say is that culture is the biggest TVL in any economy, right? In terms of what we spend. So when we think about our furniture, our clothing, our cars, our jewelry, our watches, our, you know, all that stuff. Actually, that's investment in culture. Because what culture is, isn't just basically my sort of, you know, what I own, but it's also the expression of who I am. For instance, I'm buying this shirt, or I have this Bored Ape, or I have this Mochaverse. These are all things that express who I am because we do everything mostly to sort of signal our social identity. And so the Web3 space has really evolved itself in that manner because I would say that meme coins are perhaps the best expression of that culture, right? So, you know, from the outside, you might go, what the hell is this? Why are people all into dog coins? And like, what's going on here, for instance, right? And you know, what is Solana? Why does that make sense, right? And all that kind of stuff that's happening there. But actually what's happening is it's people expressing their own liberal values of culture and saying, you know, before in the Web2 world, you know, we existed on platforms and they kind of told us the rules. They told us what we can do and how we should tell these stories, right? You had a top-down way in which culture was told. But in Web3, it's decentralized. So we're telling our own stories, whether it's initially through NFTs, which are really big in and gaming, but then also through meme coins, right? And so meme coins themselves aren't to be looked at as just sort of the speculative item, which of course has elements of that, but it's really an expression of the culture in which we are in, which also comes with a macroeconomic narrative, which is around how the world is kind of fucked up, if you want to think about it, right? Between sort of, you know, the people who have extreme wealth and the people who don't have wealth, the narrative around meme coins and the culture it represents is a representation of that. And again, if you're in the privileged class, you won't understand it because you're not in that world. But if you're actually, you know, where 99% of the world is, then you start to understand, you know, why is Web3 important? Why do we need to have digital property rights? And how do meme coins play into all of this? And why it's driving the industry? And why it's, you know, Web3 gaming is going to change the world. But anyway, lots to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, one of those big things, I mean, you were, again, as ever, very early on the understanding of mimetics and storytelling and culture and how these all come together. And, you know, as you said, when we spoke about it in the past, NFTs were the first kind of showing of that. Well, we actually saw it with GameStop as well. Same kind of thing. And it basically was a fuck the system. We're going to do something differently. And there are no rules here in terms of there's no guy in a suit telling you what you should and shouldn't do. So it becomes a pure expression of culture. And culture has gone from being an intangible to a tangible asset because that's what tokenization does. And that's a really interesting concept. And
yes, absolutely.
And meme coins also, as you are suggesting, really represent the kind of desperation of society as well, that people will take more risk than most people would have taken, older people would have taken, because they didn't need to. But these young people need to take risk.
Well, I would say on that topic, I would say generally speaking, I think people broadly have to take risk. I don't think there is such a thing as, you know, you, and by the way, you don't have progress without risk. I mean, that's the other thing, right? Whether you're an entrepreneur, whether you want to sort of branch out in something new, right? I mean, progress of any kind comes with the fact that you're taking some risk of some sort. Because otherwise, if you all take the safe route one way or the other, and we hope for a harmonious outcome, then, you know, basically you won't see much development because you won't see much disruption. And that, by the way, is the other macro thematic, which is, you know, Web3 is also through digital property rights is really the purest expression of capitalism, I would say. And when people talk about volatility in the market, which is what they don't like, actually what they don't like is capitalism. Because inherently capitalism is volatile because the nature of what capitalism does, which is disrupting, which creates change, which creates innovation, is, you know, volatile. I mean, whether this is a Tesla, whether this is going into solar energy, whether this is, you know, open AI, right? Whether this is blockchain, for instance, these are disruptive innovations, but they're driven because of capitalist structure, right? If you don't have capitalism, you don't have the incentives to create these structures, you don't have disruptive innovation, you don't have progress, right? And I think, by the way, I think that's one of the big conflicts we have in the world today, which is you have one camp in the world that's saying, we don't like this disruptive change, it's problematic. But I actually think the undertone of that sort of messaging is more about, we have a certain social world order, which protects the 1%, and we'd like to keep that somehow. And so things like blockchain is disruptive to that. And maybe even if they don't fully understand it, they resist it because of the fact that it's creating this disruptive change. But if you embrace capitalism, truly embrace capitalism, then disruptive change is who you are and what you are and what the ecosystems are about. And so meme coins is another expression of that. And culture has always been, if you think about it, connected deeply with a sense of value. The value doesn't have to be something that has to be monetary, but it's personal in nature. It's the, you know, like it's my status is very valuable, for instance, for some people. You know, where I live, nationalism, patriotism is very valuable to you as an individual. You can't quantify it necessarily purely as in terms of monetary value, but it is immeasurable in terms of its importance to you as an individual and the society you're plugged into, which you can see with NFT collections, for instance.
Also, I think one of the key elements that crypto has, and this applies to NFTs and meme coins and everything else, is that it is the same asset for everybody in the world. And it is, so it's the only global homogenous asset class. And it's fractionalizable down to the smallest denominator. So everybody can put 10% of their paycheck in, regardless, which you can't do with Fifth Avenue property, or you can't do with all sorts of things. Most people are shut out of the system. But, you know from your travels, and I know that, you know, people in the Philippines, people in Indonesia, people in South America, people in Africa, people in London, New York City, or Vienna have access to the same product, so the same set of opportunities.
Yes. So, I mean, you know, speaking of gaming, as in Philippines, right, if you might remember, you know, one of the big, one of our portfolio companies and their big successes, you know, was Axie Infinity, right? Sky Mavis coming behind that. And then, of course, you know, during the crypto winter, everyone was saying it's dead. And, you know, what's interesting is literally just a day ago, the New York Times, the headline story was, the title goes, "What meltdown? Crypto comes roaring back in the Philippines." I mean, and I think that's just, really? You know, and specifically highlighting the story of how Axie Infinity basically sort of came back in a big way, but also in part because of Ronin blockchain and also because of the launch of Pixels, another one of our portfolio companies launched on Ronin, brought users in to, I guess, brought new users as well as using the existing users of Axie Infinity to create a new gaming system. And I think Pixels today was, I think, 300,000 or 400,000 DAUs, probably sort of the biggest blockchain game right now. And what's happened is that those users that have gone into Pixels are like, hey, you know what? What's happening with Axie Infinity? Let's go try out that ecosystem. And here you see the perfect example of what happens in Web3 when network effects are being shared. Because I'm in this game, I can go to another game, I can see that ecosystem, value can be liquid in the sense that I can sort of transfer my value from one to another. Not necessarily it has to be droppable. It just means I can sell and then I can buy something else. And so the broad growth of an ecosystem means everyone in Web3 sort of benefits. And this is the other thing, which is, you know, we've been taught, I think, incorrectly so. And frankly, I think also from a human nature standpoint, to think that humans are inherently greedy and that we're basically just out there to get each other. And so all the systems and the game theory that's designed is around this type of thinking, which really suits the one percentile, if you think about it. But actually, when you think about human society as a whole, if everyone was truly like that, then actually we should still be cavemen, because actually the sort of social bonding that we have and the sense of community that we create, which I think NFTs and actually, you know, tokens and like meme coins, for instance, represent really well, is actually really, really strong. Right? It's a sense of, you know, it's a sense of self that comes from that. And that's actually who we are, because if we're not a community, if we can't come and social bond, then actually, you know, it literally is, you know, Lord of the Flies, and we wouldn't have screens and we wouldn't build stuff together, and we'd be in Stone Age. So again, I think we've thought about this wrong. And I think Web3 demonstrates that when you build stuff together and you're sharing in the network, it's broadly better in progress. Now we have a $2.6, $2.7 trillion industry that was declared dead a year and a half ago, for instance, right? And there's no other asset class in the world where the common person, and I mean that in the most respectful manner, of course, right, has a way in which they can participate in a growth economy of the future. I can't think of any asset class in the world today or any opportunity where you can do this. I mean, everyone talked about AI. Great for the, what, 0.1% investors who got to invest in that. And everyone else basically just becomes a tool, because what people also forget is if you use AI, you actually make the AI smarter and better in the progress. And who benefits? The owners of the AI. And in Web3, we all are owners, right? And that's, I think, the big thing, right? Digital ownership belongs to all of us. It literally is the biggest people's movement out there.
Hey, everyone. We're going to take a quick break right now to hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back.
Eating better is easy with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to go in just 2 minutes. You'll have over 35 options to choose from every week, including Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. There's also more than 60 add-ons to help you stay fueled up and feeling good all day long. Factor is the perfect solution if you're looking for fast, premium options with no cooking required. Their restaurant-quality meals are ready to heat and eat whenever you are. There's no prepping and no mess, so there's no cleanup needed. Get as much or as little as you need by choosing your meals every week. Plus, you can pause or reschedule your deliveries anytime. Head to factormeals.com/journeyman50 and use code journeyman50 to get 50% off. That's code journeyman50 at factormeals.com/journeyman50 to get 50% off.
Hi. On the 5th and 6th of June 2024, I'll be speaking at the largest AI event in Asia, Super AI in Singapore, at the iconic Marina Bay Sands. Alongside brilliant minds like Edward Snowden, Benedict Devon, and Balaji Srinivasan, I'll be on a stage exploring the extraordinary potential of AI and the profound change it represents, not just for financial markets, but also for the world as we know it. With over 5,000 attendees and over 150 side events, Singapore will become a vibrant hub for a full week from the 3rd and 9th of June. Visit superai.com to register and join me with 20% off tickets using the code REALVISION. Use the link in the description and I'll see you there. It's going to be incredible.
I was rereading this weekend randomly Guns, Germs and Steel by, what's his name, Jared Diamond. Amazing book. I mean, I don't know how we can write a book so dense and so clever. But part of this was talking about how small tribes, well, even before tribes, how small gatherings of humans then become tribes and then become societies and then become these big, complex, adaptive societies. And it is this action of the many that does it. Yes, sometimes they've got leaders. If not, there's a group of elected leaders. And what I'm thinking, and I think you'll probably share this as well, is this whole Web3 world is a new digital world we're creating where we can live physically in Hong Kong or the Cayman Islands, but we can also operate within this world, call it crypto land, that's made up of lots of different states and different things and different asset classes and all of that stuff. And we're still organizing ourselves within it. And things like tokens and NFTs actually help organize memetics in the same way religion does, for example. I mean, there's definitely a religious element to even Bitcoin. So it just feels like we're reorganizing a digital society from scratch and learning that way.
So the way I think of this is that, it is using digital technology, but I think we're just reorganizing and optimizing our human experience. So at the end of the day, regardless of whether this is crypto or AI or whatever it is, we're still optimizing for a human experience, right?
Yeah.
And I think the human experience here is about how we can organize, but in this trustless, permissionless system in which we can still actually, ironically, trust everything. Right? So one of the reasons why, you know, when you think about our origins as a human species, we were hunter-gatherers. But the reason why the hunter-gatherers were limited in size between 100 to 150 people, because of the famous sort of Dunbar's number, which is saying that as a human, you generally can only really know what everyone does at around 100 to 150 people. And we see this in organizational problems as well. Frankly, if you're running a startup or a company and you go from 50 people to 100 people, you start losing track and you're like, okay, I kind of remember what this guy does, but I don't know everything he does. By the time it's 150 people, it's like, okay, I kind of know everyone's name maybe, but I got to remind myself. By the time it's 500 or 1,000 people, forget it, right? I've gone through the same experience with you know, the Animoca brands grew, I don't remember, I don't even know everyone because it's impossible. We're all over the world, right? And so then you need these top-down structures. And in society, those became the kings or essentially the leaders of the space. And they created order. And how did they create order? They created a form of record keeping. And that record keeping was maintained by a central authority. The king says he owned the house because I signed it, he owned the house. But still, we delegated our authority to some master who told us how life should be lived. And that was the only system for a long time. And with blockchain, you now have a way in which you have a way in which this authority is essentially owned by the community, because now I can verify who did what without actually needing a central authority. And that's actually the thing that's fascinating about DAOs and the whole new structures. Like, I think, for instance, the companies of the future will be run this way because the interest will be more common. A lot of people sort of criticize it because they say, you know what, you can't have a, you know, you can't have a top-down organization. I mean, an organization that's not run top-down because they don't have the leadership and they don't have vision, whatever. But, you know, that's what people, that's what kings used to say about peasants and merchants. And that's what people used to say before. But when knowledge is there, actually, you can create better self-organization. You just need a structure to support and trust that. And blockchain does that. And now, you know, you have, you know, I tell people about DAOs. I don't know what the recent figure is, but I think it's maybe close to $25 to $30 billion locked in DAOs. That is essentially run by communities who can fund your project or, like, you know, support an ecosystem or do a charity. And they don't have to go through like some business leader or some top-down guy who basically, you know, is the person that that sort of controls everything because the community votes on it, right? And, you know, that's pretty astounding. And again, that figure was $12 billion a year and a half or 2 years ago. It was like close to zero, probably 5 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a member of a few DAOs, but one of the ones, yeah, because they can have very specific purposes. So that one of the ones that I'm a member of recently joined is called The Doomed, and all it does is collect X-copy NFTs. You know, and we've seen that with Flamingo DAO. So you can coalesce interests in this little digital society that operates everywhere and nowhere. You have a group of members who are able to vote around a common purpose, and you execute that purpose. Could be a business, could be a collection of art, could be anything. Now, one of the things you talked about, which has struck with me forever, which came, we talked about the fact that this opens up the opportunity for universal basic equity. I don't know if you remember that conversation we had.
Universal basic equity is a favorite topic of mine. And the reason why is, you know, I don't believe really in universal basic income, not because I don't think it's a noble idea, but because of the fact that it removes the human incentive, which to me, like, for instance, the whole thing about capitalism is that it drives innovation, right? I can't think of a better engine in the world that has given all the progress we've experienced in the hundreds of years prior came from the capitalist incentive, right? Which means that the world does have a certain level of inequity, not because, you know, we don't want to have a more fair world, but because it drives and motivates people to achieve something. And that's basically what's driving the engine of all the sort of inventions that we see today and the progress that we have. And so my point is that I think the world will be better off if we all have a share in what we build in, rather than basically sort of get paid for it in sort of some kind of income, which basically is still centrally controlled and can be devalued. I mean, pre, you know, QE, money had a value still, and people had a belief in this, that, you know, it'll be sort of something that, you know, has long-term sort of, I guess, the store of value element of money was something that was, you know, I guess, somewhat sacrosanct until QE came about in the massive scale that it did. And suddenly, you know, basically people got literally diluted out of their savings. And that's something that, that would solve for that would have been actually if you owned equity, whether it's a fraction of your house, whether it's shares in some company that was growing, like whatever it is, right? And so to me, it was more like, well, wait a second, if we're all contributing to these networks, we should own a stake in it. But the problem isn't that we couldn't own a stake. The problem is there's very few systems in the world that can do that. So if you're a public company, how can you have 100 million shareholders? Like really, like in the current system, it doesn't work, right? You know, I mean, we're a public company. We have to issue prospectus. We have thousands of shareholders. When we issue a prospectus, it takes us like 29 days and we have to print the damn thing. Like, you know, so all these things are manual, right? And then we have to count and vote. I mean, literally, that's why elections have to be these massive things, because how do you get and verify, you know, hundreds of millions of people to vote on whatever it is that they have to vote on? So this is where blockchain comes to the rescue, because you can literally scale an organization through that proof whether it's voting, whether it's ownership, whether it's these things at scale verified, where I, you know, like for instance, I, to me, every holder of Ethereum or every holder of Solana or every holder of EDU or ApeCoin, they're actually all stakeholders. They're in a certain form equity holders in the sense that they contribute value to the network, they can earn value in that network, and they're rewarded for it in the long term as well.
You know, this universal basic equity idea really is across everything, whether it's participation in a network, as you say, Ethereum, Solana, but it's also, I thought, was brought to life by Axie Infinity. Axie was really something new when it first came about. And this whole idea that you were very early on, which is that gaming is the part of the future. And part of that is how we can participate in these online societies. So talk us through the whole gaming thesis that you've got, which you've obviously built an entire business around.
Yeah, I mean, we have over 150 gaming investments today, you know, from our portfolio of 400 plus. And, you know, one of the big thesis points that we had around gaming was that we were, this was the way in which we were already trained on the pre-metaverse, as it were, right? I mean, when you talk to a gamer about owning their, you know, digital sword or their virtual currency, they don't think that they're renting something, even though they are technically. They believe they own it, and therefore they have a stake in it, and therefore they, it's easier to convert a current gamer, particularly in Asia, for instance, you know, into from someone who's playing traditional games into basically Web3 blockchain games, because they already have a sense of ownership with that. So that's kind of how we approach that thesis. And I think you know, gaming is one of the biggest narratives again, basically in 24. And also, I think gamers understand virtual ownership because they kind of already existing in that space. And now what's also happened is that many of the early games were not as developed. Because remember, it takes 3-4 years to make a good game. And all of these games are now going to launch in the, you know, basically this year and next year. So I think 24-25 will be an amazing year for gaming for that reason.
What are you seeing in gaming? What are we to expect? Because, you know, I think there's a quantum change. From everybody I speak to, they're like, well, you need to be prepared for what's coming, because the gaming world in Web3 is going to be almost undifferentiable from the experience from, you know, Unreal Engine or whatever it may be. What are you seeing?
Yeah. So it's not really the experience in the same sense. It's to say the actual game experience is the ownership element on Web3 that makes it so powerful. So meaning that the ability to earn, for instance, from a game actually comes from the ownership element. It doesn't come from the fact that the game creates that mechanism. The fact that I own the asset, I could sell it, or someone gives me an airdrop because it's rare or special, or my status is there, for instance, right? So the value basically is the ownership element. And that's really the experience of the gameplay itself. It's going to be very similar to, you know, some of the existing games. There will be some new mechanics that are enabled because you have ownership. Like trading is an example of that, but it's not going to change the core gameplay. Like a first-person shooter isn't going to change its gameplay because of the fact that you have ownership. But the fact that you have ownership allows a new meta level of gaming, meaning I can trade my assets. I can sort of, you know, move it to another game. It could be interoperable. It could be an asset I could pledge, right? And you kind of see this in the physical world as well when you look at Pokemon. Pokemon is a game, but the cards themselves became assets that were traded and had value because the community established a culture around that. And I kind of go back to this point about culture. A culture is the most important thing to society, and it has, because it binds us. And also, therefore, by extension, because we think of blockchain and metaverses essentially as digital culture, gaming is really the biggest emerging digital culture in the world today. You know, why do we have, you know, screens that sort of blink, and why do we have curved screens? And, you know, all these things came because of gaming. So gaming is the one culture that was born digitally, but influenced the physical world. I mean, NVIDIA would not be the company it is today if it wasn't for gamers trying to buy the fastest graphic card to experience an entirely virtual experience, right? Right? They didn't buy a graphic card so they can sort of, you know, have a physical benefit from it. They bought this expensive graphic card so they could have a virtual experience, so they could immerse their mind in something that was really powerful, that was more valuable to them. And then, of course, because of the GPUs and because of that, we had initially the mining and blockchain, and then afterwards AI, right? So gaming is the foundation for really, I think, many of these fastest growing industries. And therefore to us, it would not be at all a surprise that gaming is going to be what's driving Web3.
Also, I think the gaming attitude and the fact that everybody who's young grew up on gaming dictates how they operate online, how they even meme coins, you know, it becomes a game. It's a gamification of the world, which is not good or bad. It just is, because that's how they grow.
I mean, the thing that we often say also is that, I mean, life is a game, right? And in you know, I think for many people, you know, you could argue that's just a badly designed game for them. And I think one of the wonderful things about what we can do about Web3 and blockchain is that we can actually help design, you know, whether it's through DAOs or whether it's through this, you know, that differentiation with what we hope to see for some kind of equity share and universal basic equity, all sort of stakeholder capitalism perspective in Web3 is sort of design life in a better way. And by the way, that is what society has been trying to do for, you know, centuries and centuries, right? Through political innovation, right? And change, right? Which is, you know, the kind of, I mean, the fact that we're sitting on a broadly democratic framework that is hundreds of years old, if you think about it, in its principles, is on one hand amazing, both amazing and a little ridiculous, right? I mean, shouldn't we have come up with some better democratic system that is more inclusive of the people in this day and age, right? And yet here we are. And part of the reason, I think, it's because it's dangerous to innovate on political systems, right? If it goes wrong, as we have seen elsewhere around the world, you know, and by the way, that's what economists, you know, do to our nations when they basically play around with economic systems, whether it's abandoning the national currencies like Argentina, or whether it's doing QA, whatever it is, whether you follow Friedman or Keynes, whatever system you are, these are still ideas. These aren't science. These aren't immutable things that, you know, are proven by one form or the other. They're theories based on ideas. And when you have the wrong theory, you completely screw things up, which is one of the reasons why I think democratic institutions have difficulty in innovating in physical space, because it's dangerous. But I think this is where DAOs are interesting, because with DAOs, you can start experimenting at the pace of technology. So we could launch hundreds of DAOs, thousands of DAOs, and then we can learn which ones are the best governance systems, with a much lower cost than if we started experimenting on our country, right? I mean, that would be very dramatic if it went wrong.
We're going to take another quick break to hear a word from our partners.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Join over 5,000 attendees for the largest AI event in Asia at Super AI Singapore, June 5th and 6th, 2024. Raoul Pal, Benedict Evans, Balaji Srinivasan, Edward Snowden, and over 150 others will join the industry's most influential to explore and unveil the next wave of transformative AI technologies. Singapore will become a vibrant AI hub for a week from June 3rd through June 9th, with over 150 side events that will make for unparalleled networking opportunities. Visit realvision.com/superAI for 20% off tickets with the code REALVISION, or click below.
I don't think many people have got DAOs right yet, if I'm honest about it. I think it's interesting, but I think people have struggled. They've struggled with how to create direction, how to not end up with it. Interesting. You know, I watched I watched very closely the Ape DAO, which I know you're on the foundation of, right? You were, and I almost joined it for a while. And it did scare me a little bit because of how difficult it is. And unless you get the structures right, it's tricky. It's tricky to manage community interests plus project interests, keep focus without being distracted. Have you seen good examples of that?
I mean, first of all, I do think ApeCoin is an example of a DAO that works quite well. And the reason why I think it works quite well is because it has a somewhat chaotic but democratic discourse, and ideas are flowing, and nobody necessarily has to agree with everything. So in other words, a DAO where everyone agrees on everything all the time, to me is a failure. Because actually there is no discourse. Yeah. Right? You may as well, you know, have top-down control and give it to a bunch of leaders and run it, right? That's not a DAO. That's a classic hierarchical organization, right? In fact, the successful DAOs are the ones that are disruptive, that actually are maybe controversial, that debate ideas that don't agree with each other. And that's okay, because that's actually how ideas form, right? And by the way, I think this is the unique formula of America, because America is probably the only country in the world that I can think of, or at least safely say, where destruction is a thing. Like, you can build something in America, totally destroy an industry and emerge from it stronger through innovation, despite the fact that it is potentially destroying jobs and destroying economies, but creating new ones, and survive as a nation and become stronger for it. Almost no other country in the world, I think, can do this. So they try to manage innovation in a very sort of, you know, like holistic and harmonious way. But here's the thing, change and harmony are actually not the same thing, if you think about it, right? You choose who you want to be. So this is when people say, let me emulate Silicon Valley, for instance, or let me emulate sort of, what was happening in America. And I remember back in the day, that's what they all tried to do, but they didn't want the changes, right? No. They overregulated because they were afraid of that on one hand. So you actually dampened the effect, and then you have Europe, right? So you have these things where, you know, you desire that, but you can't, it doesn't come with that. And so to me, I think ApeCoin DAO is a success because, look, it's a $2 billion DAO, right? You know, think about that, right? $2 billion of liquidity available for community funding, run today by an entirely elected board, an entirely elected working steward group. You know, none of the original people who were involved in the formation of it, including myself, were community members. I participate in the forums, but I'm not in the special council. I don't have a say other than the tokens I could vote on. You know, we decentralized, by the way, a number of our token holdings to our community, the Mochaverse, who've become essentially like a super PAC. It's a demonstration of a political system. And you are right that, the DAOs, there is no DAO that runs it perfectly. But you know what? I don't think it ever can, because it's an evolution in the same sense that we can't say there's any democratic system in the world that runs perfectly either. And in fact, I would argue a perfectly run democracy might not be democratic after all, right? So there's a whole element around sort of we have to innovate and make these changes, and there will be progress, and we'll always reach that point. It's kind of like Bitcoin mining, right? You get to that halving point and it gets better. And the next halving point, right? You get to a point where, you know, you're slowly innovating to the point and the rate of changes becomes smaller because of the fact that you're getting better at it, but you're never reaching, you know, 100%. I don't think that's possible.
We're also human, so it's never going to be perfect, right? It's always going to be messy. Right.
Yes.
And it's interesting, as you say, just see the pace of innovation, people testing ideas, some don't work, some are getting better, somebody learns from it, keeps moving. And, you know, crypto time cycles are much shorter than almost any other industry on earth. So you get to go to that iteration.
It compresses it, absolutely.
Yeah. And that's really interesting. So spinning on to a different topic, what's the state of NFTs for you right now? Where are you seeing that? I mean, it's been an NFT bear market. There's a bunch of, you know, it was the hot thing of 2021. I mean, I've been buying high-end NFT art in the bear market because I think it has extreme long-term value. But what are you seeing at a broader perspective in NFTs right now?
So first of all, NFTs as a market, we're currently at a monthly run rate of NFT sales at around $1.6 to $1.7 billion a month. So, you know, I mean, I wouldn't call that too bad when you consider, but I think what's changed about the NFT market is it's become more diverse. So the NFT market was very Ethereum focused back in 21.
Yep.
And today it's become much more diverse in some way, looking at ordinals, which by the way, I'm really excited about, because to me, that is the true introduction of culture into Bitcoin for the first time ever.
Finally.
And by the way, I also think, And by the way, that's the reason why, you know, suddenly Bitcoin miners have another reason to exist and also a more sustainable way for mining to continue, because we can't hope for Bitcoin to really be worth millions and millions. I mean, yes, that'd be wonderful. But on the other hand, is that the sustainable path, or is there actually an operating reason to do that? And ordinals have represented that in the same way, by the way, that, you know, ERC 721 has done for Ethereum and all the other ecosystems around, right? And then when you mix in Solana and, you know, when you mix in basically the other ecosystems, you know, I think, again, NFTs as the probably the most direct representation of your stores of culture, actually are the ways in which, you know, I think the ecosystem will grow fundamentally. Also, in 22 and 23, during the bear market, many people joined the, at least in Asia, joined Web3 because of NFTs. So they joined for the culture. And so that's changed the makeup as well. So you will have noticed, for instance, that, you know, back in 21, the majority of your NFT collections are up for sale, right? Because everyone's just trading, right? It was just it was literally the degen traders game. And that's also because most of the people were in Web3 for the money, right? But in the NFT collectors of today, or the people who hold virtual land or hold Bored Apes or hold Mochaverse or whatever, they're actually now looking at it from a sense of community, from a sense of culture. And the number of NFTs that are for sale actually are much lower because they're using it for utility. And utility, by the way, doesn't have to be gaming only. It's literally membership, right? You know, one of the powerful things about when you sell...
We have a big, I don't know, 10,000 people in the Real Vision NFT community of membership, benefits, networking, all of this.
Yes, correct. And imagine, you know, here's the thing. And this is about identity, what's so powerful about NFTs. When someone sells their Bored Ape, everyone in the network knows. And they have to go out and literally apologize why they sold it. Oh, I need to buy a new house. Oh, my grandma's sick. And, you know, maybe it's true. I'm not saying you can't do that. But the fact that they felt compelled to do so means that they are connected to that community emotionally much more than just a trade of a fungible token. Right? And that, by the way, is how nations are built, because communities are that too. If I sell my house in my neighborhood, I immigrate to another country, I'm basically saying bye to a certain community, right? I'm leaving them. Whether this is abandonment or whether this is departure or whatever it is, or maybe you do it out of spite. And many people leave countries for all sorts of reasons. But the point is, it's a very public signaling. And in Web3, that's amplified, right? Because everyone gets to see it, right? So I think that sort of hyper level of transparency actually creates stronger bonds in community as a result, right? Which is why tokens and NFTs have this incredible power to form capital and community in a way that doesn't exist elsewhere. Because, for instance, if someone buys a Louis Vuitton bag or a Birkin bag or something, only the person who bought the bag knows, and maybe the person who sold it. The rest of the guys have no idea, and they don't know who they are, and there's no way to build a community. So you know, I know that we need platforms like SocialFi platforms to help make it easier to connect with each other in Web3. But in a sense, I think NFTs are a great representation of building the first social networks through basically on blockchain.
I mean, one of the interesting ones is, you know, obviously I'm a ape holder and a punk holder and all of this. But if I look at punks, I mean, I think it's 90% haven't changed hands at all in the last two years. I mean, people thought Bitcoin was incredible, but these are like diamond hands. I mean, nothing trades.
Yes, absolutely. And you wouldn't want to. I mean, again, I go back to the national example. I mean, you know, if you are an American citizen and you love America, then why would you give up your citizenship, even though they tax you a lot, or maybe because whatever it is? Like, there's many reasons why people might say, I don't want to be an American. But, you know, giving up your membership in America as in giving up your passport, it's a big deal. And even if someone offered you a lot of money for it, let's say America was a membership that you could buy yourself into, many people will never sell it, because it means something much more to them than just simply the value embedded, right? And I think that's one way to think about how we think of NFTs, because they are, you know, stores of culture. And what is culture? Culture is our identity. And ultimately, humans are social creatures, right? I mean, you know, there are many things that we're not, I mean, if you think about even some of the crazier stuff, like, you know, flat earthers, for instance, or like, you know, all sorts of conspiracy theories around them, right? You know, they get embedded to these communities, you know, probably for all the wrong reasons, who knows. But then they become so connected to them socially that leaving them, even if they know it's not true, is social suicide. And that's actually more expensive and more difficult than actually, anything financial in value, right?
And also, I think that in a world where AI agents are going to play a larger and larger role in what we do and how we operate, right? Firstly, universal basic equity is a perfect way of us participating in social groups.
And yes, exactly.
Humans, I think, will just end up being social creatures, whether that allows us to earn this universal basic equity concept or help each other out in DAO functions where we do similar-minded things. It feels like the world is going to push us this way anyway, towards being more human, but just in a digital space.
I agree. And I think, you know, the one thing when you think about universal basic equity as well, is that at the end, what's most important for us is to prove who we are and to be authentic, right? And that's what the premium goes to authenticity, right? And the only way to be authentic in at scale in a digital sense is actually through blockchain, right? I mean, that's the reason why we launched Mochaverse and with Mocha ID, because that's a way in which you can have a sovereign identity layer that is yours, in which you can build your reputation that you can't be taken away. Because think about today in Web 2, where's your identity layer? It's on Google, it's on Facebook, it's on Apple, which they can take away, by the way, right? And then all your identity that you've created is gone, right? All the reputation you've built, all the benefits that you've accrued into your own networks disappear. You know, we have this sort of thesis around, you know, we first started talking about content being the platform. Basically, if you have a Bored Ape, that's a platform. But we also talked about how, you know, we as end users are platforms of our own, right? I mean, you know, you're obviously a big platform in the sense you have many followers, millions of followers and all that kind of stuff on your channel. But actually, even on the micro sets, you know, your mom might have a network of 50 people. She's a platform. You know, how often does she recommend a restaurant? How often does she say, this is nice, or you should do this, right? She's a platform of her own, right? And what the Web2 platforms have done so well is disintermediate that and take away the value of that recommendation and that sort of value formation into their platforms and then sell it back to us in advertising when we are, in fact, the biggest media platforms of our own. So with Web3, you can now disintermediate this in such a manner where we can literally build micro platforms, which I think NFTs have demonstrated. Like, you have scalable, just think about this, right? You have scalable NFT communities at scale worth tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars, with really only 2,000, 5,000, 10,000 members. In Web2, that doesn't work. 10,000 of anything is nothing. You're not a business, right? But when you take it to the physical world, if you're a restaurant and you have 10,000 customers, holy shit, that's a big restaurant, right? I mean, that means you're doing well, right? That's actually how value is formed. And so we've been taught, because of the zero property rights narrative in Web2, that somehow a digital user isn't worth much, when in fact, the digital user is worth just as much as a physical user in the meta sense, right? And so Web3 basically enumerates that. And that means we have to own equity in that space, right? Because it's not going to be possible to own physical land for most people, but they can own virtual equity. And I don't mean that just in the form of land. It could be tokens, it could be NFTs. And it's in the very networks that you help construct and build. And that to me is how you build a fairer world and a more inclusive one. And you know, when you think about the economic growth that we've seen, really the balancing, the growth of the middle class is a evolution that really only happened in recent history, post-World War II, right? And in the last 20 years, it sort of fell off a cliff. Most of society actually never experienced this sort of more fair growth, right? It didn't happen in the Middle Ages. It didn't happen in the 17th or 18th century, right? Or times before. So it's a recent phenomena. And we kind of tilted back into this sort of, you know, one percentile. And I think, to me, this is where Web3 comes in. It's kind of like I view technology as the antidote of the problems we create, right? And so Web3 and the stakeholder capitalist way in which we can all participate with universal basic equity is now a way in which we redraw, but in a bloodless way, a new order in which we're able to basically participate. And it creates more balance because we now all not just have hope, but we also own a piece in the future networks that we help construct. And I think, to me, that is the big hope. And with AI, if AI generates all this value, wonderful. But who gets this value? Where does this value get distributed? To the owners of that AI, which you can tokenize.
So when you go around the world and you speak to policymakers in countries, how much of this do they get? How much of it is a threat? How much of it they're trying to embrace? Where's your, like, I know everybody's different, different countries, yes, different phases, but I just love to take your pulse on where the hell we are in that barrier, because that's the big barrier. And it's not just the standard regulation stuff. It's a mindset shift.
So I would say, broadly speaking, funnily enough, I think Asia is on the, let's say, regulatory and governmental side is ahead. And I think part of the reason why they're ahead comes from a few reasons. One, they appreciate capitalism as a population. Because just think about, like, you know, I live
in Hong Kong. It hasn't got a dirty word over there while it got tainted everywhere else.
No, it's not a tainted word. But the reason why is because we still know a time when capitalism and property rights did not exist. I mean, China did, after all, lift 400, 500, 600 million people out of poverty from a regime that had no property rights to one in living memory. My parents remembered that time, for instance, right? South Korea had a GDP in the 80s that was lower than North Korea. Just think about that, right? And now South Korea is the 12th or 13th largest GDP in the world, right? So we all remember what that was like. And so when you see these opportunities, like for instance, why is Philippines and Southeast Asia so embracing of Web3 gaming? Because actually they come from a world in which they didn't have anything, in which they didn't have property rights. And now they see the benefits of this and they'll certainly embrace it. And I think the reason why this is resisted more so in the West, particularly in America, ironically enough, is because I think we take in America property rights for granted and the ownership principles for granted. We don't, you know, we take democracy for granted because if we didn't, we wouldn't have barely 51% turnout, right? Right. If it was really that important for us, we'd be all go voting, right? But no, right? We don't appreciate it because we think it's helpless or hopeless, or we don't value it because we take it for granted, right? So I think that's one of the narratives that's different about, say, Asia and broadly the West. But I think the other one also is that, you know, there is a real urgency, a sense of urgency to sort of break away from the, I guess, let's call it American digital hegemony that exists. But when you think about Europe, even as an example, I would argue that Europe is completely digitally colonized by, you know, basically FANG, right? You know, Facebook, Apple, Google, you know, or Meta, or whatever you want to call it. Right? I mean, it was only like a few months ago when Facebook basically, or Meta as they're called now, sort of deplatformed Canadian news companies because, you know, Canada wanted to do and sort of charter tax. The fact that a private institution that sits in a democratic country, ostensibly, can actually censor and mute, democratic media of a democratic nation is insane. And here we are. And by the way, that threat is very visible to the rest of the world. So if you're an Asian country, if you're in a country in the Middle East or whatever, you look at that and you go, wait, I don't want that. So that's one of the reasons why there's been also a big push. So both including China and, has put out a Web3 policy paper. Hong Kong has been very forward on Web3. The Japanese prime minister has made Web3 in the metaverse one of his national agendas, right? Because they all also recognize that essentially they can no longer be in this kind of world, right? Outside of broader other themes like de-dollarization, obviously, is another macro theme. But it comes down to the same thing, to sovereignty.
And the other big one, I mean, people haven't really picked up how big this was, but the Russia-Ukraine, we get it. You can penalize Russia all you want in all the ways you want. Firstly, taking away their reserves meant that your dollar has less value than my dollar. Okay, that did not go unnoticed in the Middle East or China. But the big one was the abandonment of property rights and taking all of the yachts from a bunch of people and without due process. Not one person has gone to court. Now, they could be bad guys or they could be good guys. Nobody knows because not one of them has gone to court for anything. And that, you know, that changes the balance. So when you're in the Middle East and you've spent a lot of time there now, are you picking up that there's a sense of embracing this, that it gives them some sort of neutrality within this global system?
Yeah. And at the end of the day, I think, Middle East, you know, we recently announced a partnership, with NEOM. And also, you know, actually literally just a couple of weeks ago, we did an announcement with PAST, which is basically, you know, the Saudi sort of, I guess, science and research center to open up a Web3 hub at their facilities in Riyadh. So it's not just obviously UAE and Dubai, and of course, Turkey that are sort of, big in Web3, you know, even Saudi, which I kind of view as sort of like the China of the Middle East because of its sort of, you know, influence and power in the region, is now looking at Web3 and blockchain as a really, really important driver for growth, right? And you can, by the way, also see geopolitically where that's changing because, you know, when you go online with searches, you can see, you know, Saudi is technically and still is a U.S. ally, but they're also cozying up to China, right? They're doing partnerships and deals with them. And a big part of that is to have a form of independence, to be and again, this is, I guess, what every, you know, from a national sense, you want sovereignty, you want freedom, and you want to have the liberty to make the decisions that are in your national interest, which are in most cases in the interest of your people, right? I think this idea that my culture is imposed on you, right? Whether this is American culture or whatever culture, is not something that works everywhere around the world. And I think people have said, you know what, that doesn't necessarily work for us. Maybe I'll take certain elements, but I can't take all of that. because this doesn't work for where I am right now. And I think this is it. And then we go down, by the way, from a national level to the individual level. It's the same thing. You know, what do we as individuals want? We still want our freedoms. We want our liberties. We want our sovereignty at the end of the day, right? How do we safeguard that? Best way to safeguard that is, you know, a form of decentralization. I think the ones who understand that best are the ones who are deepest in the space.
Yeah, I think that makes total sense. Right, final question for you is, we talked about it beforehand. I mean, we could keep talking for hours because there's lots I want to talk to you about, but education. We've talked about that a bit in the past. So Web3 yes. and education, what's in your head there and what are you seeing?
Well, first of all, I think education is probably one of the most important things we as an industry can do to help put it forward. I think you said it quite well in one of your channels, I think, you know, when crypto was coming back and emerging, you basically went and you said, don't fuck it up, right?
Right? That's my t-shirt.
There we go. Don't fuck this up, right? And to me, one of the areas in which we need to focus our time on is education. Because, you know, the lifeblood of any society starts from training, from understanding, right? And what are the reasons we have this problem in America for Americans being anti-crypto, anti-NFTs, which, by the way, is ironic. Because I think, you know, Web3 and crypto is as American as it gets, right? It's liberalism, it's freedom, it's property rights, right? Tell me what's not American about that, right? It's free markets, right? It is as American as it gets. And yet so many Americans are like, I don't understand this and I reject this, right? That because they don't have education, they don't have training, they don't have financial literacy, right? And so this to me is a big thing. To me, you know, I think the macro is that if we move people from properly onboard them to Web3, they become financial literate. If they become financial literate, then we don't have to worry about sort of many of these financial frauds because they'll know what's going on, right? Like very few people nowadays get scammed by email scams, but you know, 20 years ago they did, right? So it comes down to education. So I think that's one macro, and education is a $5 trillion space today, right? And it, you know, Web3 is barely in it. With Open Campus and EDU, we're very active in trying to build that space as a foundation. But also I think most people around the world are not still educated enough. And I think Web3 provides powerful funding mechanisms for this. I mean, if you think about things like student loans, you know, all the financial instruments that exist around the educational space, actually, these are not optimized at all. You know, I'm currently doing college tours with my daughter and I'm going through, you know, these universities. And one of the stats that blows my mind still today is how they're proud that in their last graduating years, 21% of their student populations, and whether it's 17 to 21%, are first-time students from their family generation. Now, on one hand, that's admirable and I love that. But to me, that America still has a significant population that has generational parents that have never gone to school or university is insane. But it just shows you where we are in the world, right? And, you know, if we live in the privileged class, we don't see it, but that's the world. And that's basically what we want to fix with Web3 education, bringing capital formation with digital property rights for educational content to teachers. And just as a side note, and it's kind of funny because it was completely unprompted, you know, I think education is so important. CZ actually just recently tweeted and he said, oh, you know what? I think education is something we're looking into. Stay tuned, right? And again, this is how I see it. Like, is that it's such an important thing to society. And I think every business leader ultimately will understand the value of education. I think if we make educators and teachers generate value from Web3 and crypto, that's how we win over hearts and minds. Because you want your teachers to do better. And you want our society to improve this way. At the end of the day, gaming is going to give us growth. DeFi is going to be amazing, but it won't win the hearts and minds of people because it still seems to benefit a crowd of people that, you know, most of them can't associate with. Like, you know, most parents don't want their kids to play more games, even if it makes them money, for instance, right? But they do want better education. They do want their teachers to make more money. They do want more equity for the people who provide basically learning to all of us. And so that's one of the big reasons why I think we should embrace Web3 education as much as we can.
Yeah, I mean, that's been part of my mission ever since I discovered all of this, was, listen, this is the biggest macro trade of all time. This is the answer to the set of problems that we've been given. And really the key thing is, don't fuck this up. It's like, here's the opportunity set. Just learn what you need to do. It's actually not that difficult to get this bit right. Yes, it can be difficult to navigate everything, but just overall, to educate as many people as possible. That's what Real Vision has been doing as much as possible. I don't know.
Yes.
I'm probably onboarded more people than almost anybody else in the world just by just...
You're doing an amazing job. Yes.
Thank you. Just by talking... Now, we've had education about NFTs, education about Web3, education about everything, just to get people to understand and not be scared of it and embrace it, because it's there to change their lives. And I don't want anybody to feel left behind and say, we didn't get involved, we missed it. Because that then we've all failed, yeah? Then we failed in everything we should do, which is trying to level the playing field.
Yes, and there's still a lot of work to do, but I think there's an incredible opportunity for everyone. And I think the beautiful thing about Web3 is that everyone can get involved right now with almost no friction and no hurdles, if you think about it.
Fantastic. Yeah, as ever, fantastic. Thank you for catching up with us. Really appreciate it. We could have spoken for hours.
Absolute pleasure.
One day when you're in one place for a period of time, we'll sit down for longer.
Yeah, let's do that. And hopefully the internet connection won't be an issue.
Yeah, perfect. All right, my friend. Thanks so much.
What a great conversation. I know I'm feeling a lot better about our futures after that. And tomorrow, there's more reason for optimism as Beth Kindig and Jordi Visser join us to discuss how tech and AI investments might just be another key in the puzzle of all of us on fucking our futures. But make sure to tune in, as it's not quite as simple as you may think. Thanks for watching, everybody.